Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Vedangi Kulkarni, and you're listening to Wheel Suckers Podcast.
Today, we're talking to Vedangi about how not to cycle the world, what you would say to your 18-year-old self, and the Silk Road Mountain Race. Hi, I'm your Captain Alex, and I was raised on a tandem, and I'm an ex-cycling industry goof. And I'm with my stoker.
Jenny's Stoken here. I am the director of the London Bike Kitchen. I am the author of How to Build a Bike and also chair of the Women of Colour Cycling Collective. Hello, guest. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Vedangi and I am a 22-year-old adventure traveller. I absolutely love to ride my bike. Ideally, consistent speed and long distances. and I run a business called The Adventure Shed, through which I manage expeditions of all sorts, like literally all sorts. And yeah, I'm currently training for Silk Road Mountain Race and a couple other kind of big expeditions. But yeah, I think what I'm known by is in 2018, I rode my bike around the world and it was a failed attempt to be the fastest woman to ride my bike around the world. But I happened to become the youngest one by the time I was done. So that was great. But yeah, that's what I'm kind of known for.
Do you want to talk a bit more about that? Because it's interesting how you say it was a failed attempt, but I mean, you did it. So can you explain a bit more about how that works?
Okay, so back in 2017, the 18-year-old Vedangi decided that it would be a great idea to email Guinness about how she would like to become the fastest woman to circumnavigate the globe on bicycle. So she did. So she kind of emailed them and she kind of registered herself for this Guinness World Records and got a big kind of not booklet, but information about how to set this record. So it involves 29,000 kilometers of actually riding your bike. You have to always be going just in one direction, so unidirectional travel, crossing two antipodal points, so that's like two points on the exact opposite parts of the earth. And for me, they were Madrid in Spain and Wellington in New Zealand. And I reckon you have to use just the one bike that you started with. And yeah, so there's like kind of some rules and said, oh yeah, and also you can't go back on yourself. So all of those things I signed up for. And then I was like, oh, you know what? We got to spice it up. We don't just want to break the record. We got to smash the record. So I was like, cool. I'm going to tell everyone that I want to ride my bike around the world in 100 days. and then obviously before I actually said anything, I had to try. So I had to see what I could do. So I just I did my first 300 kilometers or more rides. And then I was like, okay, let's try this day after day. And I tried it for a week and it worked ish. I was really tired. And
your body was cooperating, though.
Yeah, it was. And I even had a slight knee injury. And in spite of that, it was not too bad. So, it was kind of manageable. And I was like, you know what? it's going to happen. Like, I'm going to put it out there that I want to do this in 100 days, which would mean riding 200 miles each day. And
wow. Like 200 each day.
Yeah, like 6 odd days of kind of transit and 4 days of, contingency. Needless to say, that didn't happen until, well, actually, I say that, but halfway through, I was like, in 55 days, I was like 9,020 miles in. So technically, I was doing all right until like at some point, and in my halfway point, I was doing all right. It's after that that a lot of things kind of went wrong one after another and didn't quite help. But yeah, so that was the idea, to do a round the world record attempt. And I had read somewhere that obviously Guinness don't do the youngest attempt, like, you know, the youngest records anymore. So I was kind of like, it's all right that they don't do youngest, but I'll know, and I'm pretty sure anyone who follows these things will know that it, like, nobody at the age of like 19 has ever kind of done that, and that's the age I was gonna be when I was gonna set off. So yeah, that was kind of what I had signed up for, essentially.
Nice. Do you want to talk a bit about what went wrong then?
Sadly, we do all love to hear about things that went wrong.
Well, that's great, actually, because those are the things that actually kind of matter, isn't it?
Yeah.
For anyone else who's going to do it. But yeah, for me, everything started and finished with visa issues. But also, obviously, there were other kind of issues that also happen. But it started with visas. Basically, at my halfway point, I had to spend like almost a week, if not, no. Just less than a week to try and get my Schengen visa sorted. So literally Halifax was just around the corner from where I was meant to fly to Portugal. But what ended up happening was that at Ottawa, I still didn't have my Schengen visa. And that wasn't something that I could apply for before leaving, because you can only apply for a visa 3 months before you get to a certain country. So like from your date of entry. And because I was in Canada on a tourist visa, it was just not going to happen. You know, it was just like really hard. So I was just knocking on different embassy doors, essentially, and just going, hey, I see you're a European embassy. Can you give me an entry? Can you give me a visa? Like, and then obviously I had letters from the Indian External Affairs Ministry and letters from the Prime Minister of India and everything. Wow. So it was like, it was a pretty big deal that, you know.
So you were doing this on an Indian passport?
Yes. I still hold an Indian passport. And that, just even to start with, that really didn't help. But yeah. Then, of course, like the visa troubles set me back a little bit. But then when I flew to Iceland, because Danish embassy issued visas for Iceland in Ottawa, and they were the only ones who agreed to give me a visa. So I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Going to Iceland. Went to Iceland, and one of the worst storms the country's ever seen happened to be around that time of the year. So you're like, great, like that just doesn't help. So I was still like, you know what, I can still go and ride. So I was riding, I rode for like 65 something kilometers, and the drivers there are horrible to start with, but also the winds and the rain. So I had headwind for the whole time, headwinds and crosswinds a little bit, and the gusts were like really, really strong, like 70 miles per hour or something. And basically it was so bad that the cars couldn't see me, I couldn't see any vehicles, and I was going at like 8 kilometers per hour. it was just horrible. And hours later, eventually the whole kind of, you know, cars not being able to see me didn't quite work well for me, which meant that a minibus kind of thing hit me, and I just hit my head onto onto a curb and fell, basically. And Yeah, I was a bit shaken up by that. But then shortly after, I decided that, well...
Did they stop?
No, they didn't, they went. But then the road was closed after that. So they, because they closed the whole kind of route, because the route across southern Iceland, they closed it because there was a red weather warning for many kind of vans and stuff. So so yeah, safe to say, like, I decided not to ride across Iceland. Flew to Portugal. And I was like, great, like, I'm going to smash this. It's going to be great. And yeah, like, what ended up happening was after Portugal, when I got to Spain, I don't even remember if it was day one or two in Spain, but basically I got mugged at knife point.
Ooh.
And we are talking a couple of motorcyclists, well, two people on one motorcycle. They basically were stalking me for a while, and I was like, nah, I'm not scared, I'll be fine. But then, yeah, eventually, basically, they pushed me off of my bike. One of them was taking stuff from my bike, and another one just kind of held, like, he was like shouting something and like with the knife in front of me. And the next thing I know, the knife was like at my neck.
Oh my God.
There's not much you can do when that's happening.
No.
But yeah, basically got pushed around a bit and got a bit beaten up. And it was a bit like, it was a horrible, it was genuinely horrible. Like, even now, sometimes if I see like a knife lying around here and there, I'm kind of like, I'm going to put that knife where it goes. I just cannot see it just staring at me like that. But yeah, anyway, back to the incident. Basically, yeah, I was seeing this guy just take stuff off of my bike. And he wasn't just taking stuff. He was just taking stuff off of my bike and throwing it. Like, looking into and throwing it. And that was just, like, very annoying. Because I was like, what on earth is wrong with you? But anyway.
Like, they weren't taking stuff. They were just seeing if something was valuable.
Yeah, they were. And that was really strange. And something that I couldn't... Yeah, I was very confused with what was happening, but also, like, because obviously when you're thrown around and you're just, you know, you don't have my, in the middle of that, I took my helmet off to hit someone with it, because I thought that would be a great idea. And as it turns out, it was like one of the lightest helmets laser made at time. So, yeah, that was like feather light. What harm is that gonna do? I know, right? So yeah, basically, that was like the beginning of the end. And yeah, after, like, before they kind of went off from like taking everything, they threw me down like the side of the road, and I knew like it went down a little because I was going uphill. And I went down head first, and I think I was unconscious because I don't remember much from like around that time. And then I do remember that there was like a thud, which was like my bike landing on me, which didn't help either. You know what? Like, when you have like just a normal crash and your bike, any parts of your bike hit you, it hurts. But when a bike is thrown on you, ouch, it hurts even more.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, after that, I couldn't remember my phone's passcode. So, like, you know, the rest is kind of like, yeah. But the thing is, I decided that I couldn't go back to the UK because my visa was curtailed. I was on a student visa at the time. I couldn't go to India because I was like, oh no, like, people might... I just didn't want to. I was like, I don't feel at home there. I just don't want to go there. And the only place I really did feel at home was just like riding my bike. But I was throwing up. I couldn't keep food down. I couldn't.
Yeah. You're in shock.
Balance, yeah. And I just couldn't understand what was going on. But this really kind gas station guy offered to help me out, and then he took me for a coffee somewhere like near this motel, and then there was a family which spoke more English than the gas station guy did, and took me to a hospital, and the hospital people were like, I like kind of vaguely remember they were trying to say something on the lines of, we need to admit you here. And I just remember panicking. I was like, no way, like, no, nobody's admitting me like that. that. So yeah, but the family was like, we can host you at ours. And then I went to theirs for like a meal or so, but then I ended up telling them like, you know what, I'm gonna go to a motel and stay there. So they booked me somewhere. Went there and it was literally a room without windows and with this very dim yellow light, and my bike was there. I was kind of just sitting there going, what the fuck am I doing? And everything was spinning. I just remember like lying on my, with like my back on the bed and just staring at the ceiling, and it was like, wow, like the world is spinning. It feels very like, it's like moving in different directions. It felt like I was on drugs or something. That's really strange. But then I also realized that if I stayed there for like longer, any longer, that was not going to be good for me. So decided it was best that I get back on the road. And it started with literally like 40 or 50 kilometers. And then I was just dead because my body couldn't handle it. It started with that, and then a little bit like 100 kilometers, and then 100 miles, and then, you know, slowly, by the time I was like around Belgium, Denmark, that sort of direction. Oh, not Belgium, Denmark. I was in Belgium when I was like, okay, I feel like I can get better. And then by the time I was in Denmark, I was like, yeah, I think I'm like definitely getting better. So I started like upping my mileage to like 300 and stuff like again. But then obviously I hit Russia, and again I had visa issues because my Russian visa had expired.
Oh no.
So I had to get a new one, and I paid for an express visa, but they took like 8 days to get it. So the day I applied, I was like, well, if they're saying they're not going to give it to me like right away, so I'm just going to book myself on a flight to Lapland. So I went to the northernmost airport in Finland. So what was it? Ivalo? Yeah, Ivalo. Then took a bus to Inari and then explored the icy forest around there. Because
so you,
why
like,
not?
You took a break.
Yeah, 8 days. That was perfect. Like, you know, that when I was back, I had my visa, and I was like, and my friends, so one of my best friends, he's Finnish, and his mum lives in Helsinki, and his mum's partner, he owns a bike shop, so they kitted my bike with winter gear, so changed my tires, made sure I had everything for like, you know, Russian winter, essentially. So, because it was, what, like, mid-November or something? So it was getting, like, pretty cold. And, yeah, and Russian winter was very wintry.
yeah,
bad. I hadn't thought. I was like, early winter, it's not going to be that bad. Oh, was I wrong? It was quite cold for all the days that I was there, actually. And for most of them, I was literally like finding places to camp at. So all of it was like the combination of things that went wrong, but things that were also like, obviously the mugging wasn't under my control, but deciding to go on was under my control. And that was like a decision that I had taken. So I don't know if I can count that as things that went wrong. But yeah, even like visa things, I never know whether to say that they were things that went wrong, but then again, they were not under my control either.
But do you think that having, because you had an Indian passport and you're trying to get into like European countries, because if you don't, again, if you don't have the right papers, racism is at work. It's institutionalized,
yeah,
racism. And they're
definitely
like, sorry, we're going to make this really hard for you to get into our country because we don't trust you, I think is the subtext, right?
Yeah, and also we don't think you have enough money, because that was also like, that was also kind of really, really strange that, if... I don't know. So every time I had to apply for a visa, there was a list of documents that I knew I needed. So stuff like my bank account, what's it called? Statements. Bank statements for the last 6 months to 12 months, for example. So like they needed to know that I had enough money. And then I had to prove that I had a certain number of, I don't know, a certain euros per day to be in a certain country kind of thing. And all of that for like a number of days. And then what's my kind of, you know, where am I going from there? So like an onwards ticket for something. So there are, that was like the biggest issue because I didn't have an onwards ticket, did I? Like I was going to ride across. So that made things slightly harder.
Yeah.
So
it's so horrible. They're like literally saying, we want to make sure you're not staying here.
Exactly. And yeah, it did make it really hard. And also like a letter of, what's it called? Letter of invitation, that one. Letter of invitation from someone in Europe.
Yeah, like you're staying with them.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Accommodation arrangements, that's one. And yeah, like, you know, what sort of travel will you be taking within the country, this and that. But
did you have to have those actually prepared?
Yeah, I was meant to like show an itinerary that I had.
Wow.
So that was where the letters from the External Ministry of India, the Prime Minister of India, the Sports Ministry of India, all of those letters came in handy when I had to do this stuff.
Yeah.
But then those letters weren't my get out of jail card. I still had to show that I had enough money, which most of the times I never did. Mm-hmm. So I had to just be like, I there was a point where I had to actually ask my friends if I could have certain, like, just to make sure I had like a certain amount in my kind of bank, and then I would like return it to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the minute I'd submitted the document or the minute I got the visa, I would just send back the money to them because like I clearly didn't need it. I was going to be sleeping on streets essentially, so I didn't need that. But yeah. That was like an interesting experience, the whole visa thing.
Yeah.
And also like to start with, I don't know if you remember, but my Canadian visa was rejected to start with because they didn't believe in my reasons to kind of be in Canada, and then they didn't believe that I was going to leave.
Why would they not believe you?
I think I still have that letter, and every time I see that, I'm just like, why is this such an issue? Like half of Canada is like Indians anyway. But yeah,
it's just, again, it's immigration, yeah. Like,
and power trips, I think, yeah. Sometimes, and maybe possible quotas, you know. Don't be mean to this many people.
Or they have to make themselves look like they're being tough on immigration.
Yeah, they don't want it to seem easy, or
yeah.
They're trying to scare people.
They tried it on the wrong person, didn't they? Because I got in touch with the Foreign and External Affairs Ministry of India at the time, and I said to them that, look, I need to have this visa by this date. Do everything that you can. And they gave me a letter. They called up the... They called up the Canadian Embassy, who then coordinated with the VFS Global in London. And somehow I went there, I showed a letter, and then they already knew who I was and what was going on. So they were like, okay, you can come back in 3 days to pick your passport up. And I just knew for a fact that they could have given my passport back the same day. I just knew that it was going to be a deal done because it was like, you know, it was a conversation that happened on the ministry level rather than, you know, someone like me.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, I hate to say like you're lucky, but I mean, in some sense.
Yeah, definitely though, because like but then again, like, we didn't already have contact in the External Affairs Ministry or anything because I knew that these issues were going to crop up. I made sure that I had some contacts there. So I introduced myself to a million people that otherwise wouldn't have like known my existence just because I was like, you know, someday I think this will be useful for me.
Yeah.
So
it worked. It
worked. Yeah. At least with this. And my dad helped with that quite a bit because I am not the one to deal with like politicians and stuff, but like, you know, as a as an Indian woman, like if you're dealing with like middle-aged or slightly older kind of politicians, like they're not going to take you seriously, which is where like my dad came in and I was like, right, like here's what I need from you, here's who you need to get in touch with, and here's what you're saying. And he's really smart, like he he got the job done.
Is he in politics?
No, he's not. No. No, he's not. Absolutely not. He's not. But he kind of was kind of, he's like, he's very keen on networking, let's put it that way.
That's good.
And he was running a business at the time, so he was like, you know, extra keen because, you know, he saw something in there for him as well. So that was great. But yeah, dad's always been like super helpful with these things. So yeah, that was like the whole kind of visa thing though.
Yeah. Can I just ask a quick logistical question? Where did you start and end your trip?
Ooh, I started and finished at Perth, Australia.
Uh-huh. So Perth was, okay, yeah.
Don't ask why, because that's a question for 18-year-old Vedangi who planned the route. And I will never understand the 18-year-old Vedangi because she was just a bit insane. Like, she thought, oh yeah, Australia in winter, New Zealand in winter, and everything else in summer. That sounds like a great idea.
And now a word from our sponsors. This show is brought to you by our Third Wheels. Want to support Jenny and Alex? Become a Third Wheel supporter and help us make episodes in 2021. Give us a one-off saddle push with a donation or become a £3 a month stabilizer or a £5 a month third wheel. Visit wheelsuckerspodcast.com for details.
We have retreated to the comfort of our homes to digitally record the Wheelsuckers podcast, which is now edited by Wardour Studios. Wardour have remained strong, providing professional recordings and editing in these unusual times. Let their team of engineers, producers, and composers be your guide. Visit wardourstudios.co.uk for more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We had an interview with you before you set off and you've already listened to it. I thought we could do a little bit of, if you've watched Drag Race, they get a photo out, but it would be 18-year-old Vedangi, like you mentioned.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, we're interested for listeners to kind of hear like what your thoughts were, like listening back to yourself, how you feel you've changed. But is there like, what would you say to your younger self now, having known what you've been through?
Ooh. That's a very deep question.
Is it too deep? Too soon?
I think when I listened to that recording, my first thoughts were, "Fee, that's bullshit. You don't know what's coming your way. That's just like, you know, stop talking, just shut up." But again, that's also like the reaction of most people who listen to their own voice, isn't it? I think in order to make myself look big, I was trying to show myself as somebody that I wasn't. So I was trying, in order to look confident, I slightly crossed that border to overconfident, which probably at the time served me well in some senses. But when I listen to that interview, I can see who I was trying to be like. I can see what I was trying to do, what I was thinking. And I kind of think that I just didn't realize that by being myself, I could get a lot further than I would with that kind of attitude, with kind of, you know, being slightly overconfident, because overconfident and arrogant has never been me. Like, you know, but then again, the world keeps, you know, talking about how confidence is the key to all big things and all that
stuff.
They do
say confidence is key.
Yeah, but like at the time, I faked it, but I faked it wrong. I faked overconfidence rather than confidence. Like, you know, like I didn't know where the line was. And that's what I realized when I listened to that. I was kind of like, also, I listened to that and I was looking at the wrong things. I gave everyone so much credit and I forgot to appreciate the fact that, hey, like I'm 18 and when I'll be 19, I'll be riding my bike around the world, and that's a pretty big deal. Like, not everyone comes up with these things and gets on with it right away, and I'm actually doing this. And I didn't give myself credit at all. I was just like, oh yeah, I was lucky. Oh yeah, like this happened, that happened, they helped me, like, you know. And it's all about everyone else who kind of, you know, like whose shoulders I was standing on, which was very much true. But if I had shown a little bit more belief in myself, I think I would have, my journey would have been happier. I think that's what, like, I saw, like, kind of lacking. So if I had to say something to, like, Vedangi back then, I would probably be like, just believe in yourself a little bit more. And obviously you can't make someone believe in themselves, that they just have to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
But so maybe the experiences that I had between then and now were extremely important for that. But at the same time, I see myself, like, I listen to myself from back then, and I just think that I should have had slightly more belief in myself. I'm not talking about confidence, I'm saying belief, the quiet belief that you can have in yourself that then at some point induces confidence. You don't have to always just fake it. Sometimes you can just quietly believe in it, and it happens when it happens. So I feel like that's something I would tell 2018 Vedangi. Was that too deep?
No, I think that was very really, wise.
Yeah.
It was very wise.
I think it's interesting because me and Jenny, we say fake it till you make it quite a lot.
Yeah.
And we've kind of been joking and saying that to each other and throughout like our lives.
Yeah.
But I think you have to have those experiences to learn it. So it's kind of, it's an interesting one. I think it's a tricky one. Because it's not that simple.
That's finding that balance, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't quite get it, like, unless you've had certain experiences, you don't quite get it, do you? Like, you kind of have to go through those things, as you said.
Let's talk about the future. What are you riding towards? What are you working on now?
So currently, I run a business called The Adventure Shed. And through The Adventure Shed, I plan and manage expeditions and adventures for other people, and also have a couple of digital products out there. So one's called Adventure Planning Crash Course, which is an online course to help people kind of plan their own adventures. And another one is called Adventure Planning Blueprint, which is like an all-in-one planning kind of system which people can download the template of and use for planning their adventures and expeditions, and it's like fully customizable, so like anyone can use it and it will kind of still be useful for whatever you're planning to do. But yeah, apart from that, like just planning and managing expeditions, but also I have some of my own planned. So next up is this, actually starts next weekend, a 1000 kilometer bike ride in southwest region of the UK. So the idea is that I was looking at all the routes that I used to ride back in like 2016, 2017. I used to just look at the map and be like, hey, look, that looks like an interesting place. Let me ride there, or, you know, stuff like that. So what I wanted to do was, and just like that, I had discovered like Devon, Cornwall, different areas of Dorset, like some areas of Somerset and Hampshire and things like that. And I wanted to put together a 1,000 kilometer loop through like gravel roads and some kind of B roads, so like country roads and stuff, kind of like a bikepacking route with key locations with some sort of adventurous interests. So places where I would wild camp, places that you can go for like a wild swim. I want as many destinations for wild swimming as possible because I've absolutely fallen in love with that. Places where you can just stash your bike, climb up a hill and back, you know, just because why not? And the whole idea came from how adventure is what you make of it. So initially I was like, oh yeah, this 1,000 kilometer route, I'm just going to do 300 a day and smash it. And then I was like, hang on there, I want this to be like a holiday, a more kind of relaxed space.
Yeah,
so like
just over, you know, it's not a race.
Yeah. So like 120 kilometers per day. And then I would do all these other things, or I would go wild swimming, I'll go like, you know, scrambling or whatever. I'll find like a good location to camp overnight. I'll cook myself some food outside in my stove, and it'll be like a date with myself and over multiple days. And you know, how cool would that be? And throughout lockdown, I'd been raving about how much I want to do this. And it started with just being like a personal project. And now it's like a professionally filmed project with like so many brands involved and everything. So it's like, it's really interesting, something that I'm definitely looking forward to. In August, I am headed to Kyrgyzstan.
Ooh.
For Silk
Road.
Race.
Yeah.
Part two. We'll see if this time I get to the start line without killing myself, almost.
Well, what happened last time?
I fell over the handlebars on my way to the start line.
Oh no!
Can you believe? And I got a bad case of concussion, and I had damaged my ribs, so I couldn't breathe properly.
Oh my gosh!
So I rode for like 75 kilometers whilst being like delirious, throwing up blood and stuff, and it was horrible. And I was like, I know it's raining and it's cold, but like, why am I able to see properly? I swear this has never happened before. Then I realized, oh shit, this happens in Spain, of course. Oh yeah, and my helmet is cracked. Oh, that's what's happening.
Oh, no.
But yeah, that was how Silk Road ended for me before it even started. But yeah, hopefully this Silk Road isn't like, yeah, fingers crossed. My mantra for this Silk Road is that this is an adventure, not a race. I know it's a race. I know. I respect that very much. But if I do not convince myself that it is an adventure before it's anything else, I will put myself in like a dangerous situation again, which I don't want to right away. Like, you know, I want to get in the groove. I want to do like the mileage I planned for the first 3 days. And then I know I'll feel confident about myself and I'll push myself.
You've mentioned that you've gotten lots of sponsors before, and I think that's something a lot of people are curious about, and I'd like to know what makes a good sponsorship proposal.
I feel like something that's well researched and unique to a certain brand. So it's not about what you kind of talk about within the proposal. Well, no, actually, it is a lot about what you talk about within the proposal. So like talking about the story, talking about what you actually need from the brand, but also then talking more about the brand than about yourself, and then tailoring everything to their needs. So at the time, like back in like 2018, I would have thought sending hundreds of proposals mattered the most, whereas now I really do think that researching the brand, knowing what they actually do need, and then tailoring everything to their needs and making an offer that they wouldn't refuse, they can't refuse, because they are only gonna, like, the way I see it now is to offer something that only you can offer, and that's the value, that's like the, that's the USP, like only you can do that particular thing that you're offering to that brand, and only you can add that value.
It's not easy, is it, with sponsors?
No, it's really not.
Like, on both sometimes sides. You think it's almost gonna work and then it doesn't, and it's disappointing, but also by actually sending that proposal out and tailoring it to the brand, it makes the brand remember you. And I think that's worked really well for, like, in my personal experience. I'm not going to, like, name brands, but there was a brand that had rejected me back then, which sponsors me now. And that's only because I pitched something that I knew, like, was slightly unique. And that was, like, the only thing that I had actually, like, that was the only brand that I had, like, taken that much effort in researching and, you know, tailoring the proposal to. And then they rejected, saying that this is not the right time, but, you know, we will remember you for next time. And what we're, like, talking 3 years later, and obviously it may be because of the fact that I did kind of do the round the world, and that was all right, but, like, still, like, they remembered me from the proposal, and they put two and two together and kind of got back in touch asking to kind of work with me. And I thought that was, like, really cool, because that kind of really showed that the research and tailoring everything to them and certain aspects of the proposal actually worked. It was very validating, I'm not going to lie.
Good. Yeah, I think that's a really fair point, though, that you can reach out to people and it not be the right time for them. And actually just creating that, like, contact or connection with a brand could play out later. Actually, because it happens a lot with, like, video game streamers, where they're always encouraged to try and get a sponsor. And it feels very much like cycling, where it's like, not only are you actually being the person doing it, but you have to be your own agent and manager on top of that.
Yeah, no pressure.
That's asking a lot of people. I'd like to say, oh, just reach out and see what happens, but still, it's not that simple. Because I don't think, you know, saying from the other side, I don't always think companies and sponsors understand what they can get from working with cyclists.
Yeah.
I don't think they realise, yeah, just reaching out and working with the people who are out there in the field can be really, really powerful.
Yeah.
So we always like to find out about new, interesting accounts. It's one of the best ways to recommend our podcast, but maybe you could recommend other podcasts. But it doesn't have to be cycling. I just think it's always really nice to hear what other accounts people, like, engage with and what they enjoy. So we'd love to get three of your recommendations.
Ooh, I think my first recommendation would be Mark Randolph. He was the co-founder of Netflix, and he has an account called That Will Never Work. He also has a book with that name, and I love following him. I think his account is one of those accounts that I go on Twitter to actually see what he's posted every now and again. So I think that's like an account that I really enjoy following. And also, I think he also, like, posts on Instagram with the same name, That Will Never Work. Another one is an adventure traveler called, well, she's more of a traveler than adventurer, but then her recent journeys have been pretty adventurous, so I'm going to go with adventure traveler called Eva Zubek. She is a YouTuber mainly and has over 1 million subscribers, and her, like, other kind of social media channels are, like, over 500,000 followers and everything as well. So, you know, she's a pretty big deal, and by some luck, I've been able to, like, chat to her a few times now, and the content she posts is incredibly, it's unique, like the stories she tells and the way she tells them are very, I don't know how to put it, like, well thought. So, you know, it's not like your average travel channel. It's very kind of interesting, and I absolutely love following her. So yeah, Eva is somebody I love to follow.
And then where can we find you?
Oh, me. I am at Wheels and Words on Instagram and Twitter. So Wheels and Words on Instagram and Twitter. My website is www.vedangikulkarni.com. My business website is www.theadventureshed.com. And yeah, on Facebook, I'm just Vedangi Kulkarni.
So whatever your preferred social media channel is, you can find Vedangi. Cool. It was really good to catch up with you.
Yeah, it was great to catch up with you too. That was awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Alex and I really love what we're doing and we want to continue, but we can't do it without your help. Become a third wheel and support us today. You'll be in good company with these third wheels: Aurelia Venschelweite, Karina Fussell, Kirsty Chestnut, Kate Thompson, Sally Bremner, Jonathan Rothwell, Ella Green, Annie McCarthy, Max Meyer, Bence Bala,
Ella B, Christina,
Luke Rocher, and Jenny Raphael.
If you like what we do, squish that
like
button.
Rate
us on iTunes and
subscribe.
If you can't give us your money,
give us your stars.
Shh, don't keep us a secret. Slam that
share
button and tell all your friends about our show.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.